if everyone could just go around and say their name, and that way we can, since we're recording this as an audio transcript, we can have a record of everyone who's on the call. So if you could just go around and say your name and your organization, that'd be great.
Well, this is Sherry Gossett-Perrin with the Texas Department of Agriculture.
Mark Wyatt with Texas Department of Rural Affairs.
Kenneth Darden with Macedonian Baptist Church, minority representative of Governor Party.
Donnie Van Rysdyk with the North Central Texas Area Agency on Aging, representing the Promoting Independence Advisory.
Amy Granberry, Governor Appointee for Health Services and State.
All right, and then myself, Marshall, and Elizabeth are on the call from the TDHCA. So thank you, everyone, for making the time. The first order of business is the approval of the April 6th meeting minutes. So I sent out an electronic copy to everyone of those minutes. Are there any changes?
I move approval.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
All right. All those in favor of approving the meeting minutes?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? All right. Meeting minutes are approved. then the next order of business is before we get into Chapter 5 and identifying barriers, that chapter of the biennial plan, I wanted to kind of go back over our meeting that we had on April 6th and just do a little follow-up discussion about that meeting. Thank you, everyone who made it. We had a lot of great speakers that came and spoke, and I provided everyone the minutes notes of the speakers who came. So I hope everyone received those notes. And in terms of some follow-up research that the staff is currently undertaking, the first thing is, based on the discussion that we had on April 6th, trying to look for examples of cross-agency coordination recommendations that have been made in other states. I'm going to stop. Is there someone else that got on?
Nick.
Hi, Nick. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
Yeah, we just started. So I'm just discussing some of the staff's current research projects for this committee. So the handout that I gave everyone, sent electronically, that was the Pennsylvania example that I found recently of, they had a home and community-based services stakeholder planning team that was similar to our group in that they had both state agency representatives, advocates, and service providers on their team, and they put together a set of recommendations for the governor in 2002. And I just took the excerpt of one recommendation section they had on cross-systems coordination for everyone to see, to give an example of, you know, what's been done before in the realm of cross-agency communication and coordination. And if everyone could look at that document, some of the follow-up research I've done after reviewing their recommendations was, and this is kind of a second research assignment of the staff, is to look at examples of single point of entry systems for accessing long-term services and care. And Pennsylvania has an online assessment tool that I've been looking through called COMPASS, and it's referenced in the document I sent you. It stands for Commonwealth of Pennsylvania Application for Social Services, and it's a fairly extensive way that both consumers and service providers can go online, learn about all the social services that are provided, including long-term care services and home and community-based services, and that consumers can, you know, from whatever internet access point, can sign up for a variety of services, have their eligibility determined, their assessment done online, and then have that assessment sent to the appropriate state agency. So I'm looking more into Compass and how, if that is a best practice that we want to perhaps recommend, and I will give you guys a breakdown of what I find. Another example that I have been looking at is in Washington. They have a computerized assessment tool that's used by those who go to do in-home assessments, and theirs is called CARE. CARE stands for, let's see, now I can't find what the acronym actually stands for. but it's basically the same type of tool of having a single assessment done for a variety of long-term services and supports. I will definitely do a write-up of that for you guys so you can see if that's another perhaps best practice in the realm of single point of entry. And then finally, just one last thing in terms of staff assignments based on previous meetings. I'm currently looking into what kind of professional organizations there are in Texas that are providing training and technical assistance that we could perhaps recommend partnering with in order to provide that that education piece to local entities that we discussed at the April 6th meeting. So right now I've been reading up on the ILRU, Independent Living Research Utilization, and I know that they've had a lot of previous work with trying to provide technical assistance and education in the communities. And so I will definitely let you know more about what I find about those professional organizations in the future. But I just want to give you a quick overview of that's what staff is looking up based on our previous meeting. And I wanted to ask if anyone had any follow-up comments that they wanted to make about our April 6th meeting, which the topic was on Chapter 8 of the Biennial Plan, which is the training and education for local entities, local service providers. Is there any follow-up that anyone wanted to discuss today?
I don't have any comments as follow-up to the April 6th meeting, but as you were talking about the online screening tool, Texas does have a website called yourtexasbenefits.com, and I think the scope is fairly limited to food stamps, Medicaid, children's health insurance programs. But one of the things that you might look into or pose to the Health and Human Services Commission, which is the agency that created the screening tool, is the inclusion of some content on housing. If it's appropriate to include it, it would have to be handled differently because unlike Medicaid, there's several different entry points for the different housing programs. But again, that might be something to look at. There's also a very, very good tool that's a national tool. I think it's somewhat limited in terms of the local resource information it can provide, but that's benefitscheckup.com, which is hosted by the National Council, I believe, on Aging. And so you guys might want to do some research, or I can do some research and see if housing resources are part of that benefit eligibility determination.
Okay.
But those are two established online screening tools. So I think if that's something that we want to look at, we'd probably be better to adapt tools that are already in place rather than try to create one that's competing.
Right, right. I definitely agree with you. I think that the research was into, you know, what are the best ones in other states and how can we then use those to add on to what is already available. So I think that's a great idea. Any other comments? That information? All right. Well, why don't we move on then to the discussion topic for today's conference call, which is there is a section of Chapter 5 of the Biennial Plan, which the Chapter 5 is identifying barriers, and one of the subsections of barriers is ineffective or limited coordination. And the reason why I thought this would be a good topic to discuss for our first conference call is because I think that a lot of previous conversations by this committee do bring up barriers of this nature, and so I thought that before we delve further into our policy recommendations and things for the chapters on cross-agency education and coordination, we probably want to start with the identification of these barriers. So in terms of the discussion handout that I sent, it's very brief, just a summary of what this section will include, some preliminary findings of coordination barriers, and then some questions about questions that I think that the committee should try to discuss, hopefully today, and in the future if we need to. So why don't I start with discussing examples that you have seen of limited coordination between state agencies and local entities, whether they be local governments, nonprofit organizations, or service providers. Can we maybe have a little begin the discussion with what limited coordination barriers have we seen between state and local entities?
Ashley, this is Nick. I just wanted to, before we get into that discussion, I just wanted to frame it a little bit more.
Okay.
In that, I mean, I think we can all agree that the coordination is ineffective and in many places non-existent, but that's just kind of a term that I think outsiders seize on when they think about government. And if we could think of a different term from ineffective, limited strikes me as better. It's just one of those things that, you know, where we're framing it as the foregone conclusion that others might have about us.
Okay. We can definitely say limited. That's a fine term. So framing it as limited coordination, I guess what examples can we discuss about potential barriers of limited coordination between state and local entities that we want definitely to be in this chapter of the Biennial Plan?
Well, I think the risk is that consumers in need are not effectively connected with the services that exist.
Okay. And how, if you want to expand upon that, about what about the connection do you think is lacking?
I don't think there's a solid knowledge base among most service providers. Obviously, some are experts in housing issues, but the average discharge planner or caseworker is likely to have limited understanding of housing programs, eligibility, availability.
Okay.
And I think one of the factors that aggravates that condition is that there's kind of a hodgepodge of organizations that administer the programs, and in many cases, even the same programs are administered differently in different cities or counties. And so with that lack of standardization, it's hard for professionals and, more importantly, hard for consumers to really know what's out there and to avail themselves of those resources.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you know, the elephant in the room is that the problem is not in inability to generate referrals. The larger problem is that, you know, with wait lists of 2 years and applications not being accepted, you know, the fundamental issue is there's a disconnect between demand and availability.
Okay. Anyone else want to join in? So it doesn't have to be on the same thing that Donnie mentioned, but any other barriers? So what I hear you saying, Donnie, is that there's the lack of knowledge between health and human service type providers and of the type of housing programs available in their area, as well as a lack of standardization of program types and availability between different geographic areas makes it harder to get that the correct information to the consumer.
Right.
Okay.
And then there's a separate issue in that consumers who have multiple complex needs, they're often assisted by people from multiple agencies or sometimes a person from one agency only who may not be able to fully respond to those other needs. And so if you've got someone who's been homeless and may have a history of chemical dependency and is frail and has a co-occurring behavioral health need, there's really not a good network of services other than in a few areas with model programs that are able to respond in full to that whole range of need.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have people who, you know, they really do have the skills to live independently, but this kind of piecemeal access to services and supports jeopardizes their ability to remain safely in the community.
All right. That's great. Anyone else want to discuss any limited coordination barriers as it pertains to state to local coordination?
I think, and this is pure speculation on my part, so the actual service providers would want to rebut or correct or whatever what I'm about to say. But, you know, I'm wondering if the pattern of contracting, it's not just the agencies, but, you know, I mean, there's a group of providers that are used to working with TDHCA. There's providers that are used to working with our substance abuse folks. Mm-hmm. There's providers that, you know, work with DADS's programs. And, you know, I wonder if the structuring of the contracts and the RFPs sort of encourages a tunnel vision among the providers.
I think that is definitely something that I believe that has come up previously in hearing from local service providers, especially at our April 6th meeting. I know that was something that Tom Wilkinson had brought up, and that's a good point, that you have all these different RFPs, different contractors, based on the state agency and state program.
Yeah, and if Tom Wilkinson is considered like the optimal model, or there are some other optimal models out there that people look at different facets of the programs, then, you know, there's a lot of coordination that has to go out because of the way federal requirements are split up in different parts of their code and go to different agencies, and which set them out in separate RFPs, about which their usual contracting partners are notified. So it's kind of it goes all the way to the verticality and the siloness of the system. I think is we have to look at it extending all the way from, you know, from the federal requirements and federal monies out to how that affects the clients.
Mm-hmm.
It's a systemic problem. Not that we can't improve it, but...
Okay, great. And any additional discussion on that? Any other ideas? Why don't we then turn to the second question, which is examples of limited coordination from state to state agencies, state agency to state agency. And I think what Nick just touched on could also be perceived at the state level of the contractors really working only with one state agency rather than multiple state agencies. So kind of having siloed contractors is perhaps something that state agencies need to look at. Any other barriers from state agency to state agency that we want to talk about when it comes to coordination?
Well, this is kind of Mark, and a kind of obvious one, but each agency kind of goes out on its own as far as outreach and web pages and training and all. For obvious reasons, you just realistically don't have enough time to coordinate all that with many, many agencies, some of which you're not familiar with at all. So I think that's probably always going to be there. I don't know how you really incentivize people to cross-link and to have a similar, you know, look and feel, but that's kind of putting down the obvious. I don't know if that's helpful, but I know we work very well with TDHCA and our, because we have a mutual interest in some of those type of projects. But once we get beyond those projects, we really don't coordinate with other providers.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. Good point, Mark.
Example.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we have a barrier of
not there.
Yeah, a lack of incentive for coordination of websites, of outreach materials,
mm-hmm.
training. Okay.
Yeah, that's just unless you have a mission statement that somewhat overlaps, and it either through agreements or just working as a match in a project or a supplemental funder, you don't really have much incentive or need, frankly, to deal with them. And given limited time and resources, you focus on your partnerships that are most important to you, and the others tend to probably never really get touched upon. And I think there is coordination if there's a close mission, and I think sometimes we do a real good job at that. But if it's not part of your core mission and you're just trying to be a conduit, I think that's where it falls down a little bit.
Would you also say that funding silos as well as law would pose barriers from that as well? Like federal laws related to funding and that sort of stuff?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I mean, do you want to expand on that at all, Sherry?
Well, I know when I was working with systems of care, that was one of the things that kept agencies from being able to fully participate and partner, because the way the laws were and the way the funding came in, they weren't able to fully participate or partner.
Okay. And do you mean partner in terms of coordinating staff efforts or coordinating what is given to the local provider, or what kind of coordination?
Any type of financial participation,
okay,
or assistance, or training.
Okay. And that was, what program were you referencing?
Systems of Care.
Systems of Care, okay. Okay, thank you. Is there any other comments? I know that we have half of the group is not part of a state agency, but you can always also chip in to, you know, the outside looking in. Any thoughts about state-to-state agency coordination and barriers to that coordination?
Has anyone been a consumer of the systems and seen how effective the consumer entering the system?
I know my son was, we looked for help, and it had nothing to do with housing. It just, you know, acquiring services. It was, if you were a square peg trying to fit into a round hole, I mean, we got bounced from agency to agency to agency to agency to agency and never quite fit anybody's criteria, which is very frustrating.
Hmm. And depending on the kind of skill level and expertise of the person answering the phone, you may get information that's of variable quality.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Consistently.
So that's more towards the education of the staff that are the direct recipients of consumer calls or of local provider calls, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other suggestions of barriers that we can put into this section?
Well, actually, this is the obvious one I know you'll put in there, but just how many joint training sessions actually occur, and is that enough, or do you need more? If you, you know, kind of say, here's what's occurred, and it's limited, I think that would kind of explain the need or value for additional coordination or training or some type of activities. I think kind of what's transpired, I know that's a little hard to gather unless everyone's willing to kind of look at their past. You know, this is the strategic time, plan time, and I just finished my agency as far as the state perspective, and part of that process, painful as it is going back and looking at the coordination and the or lack thereof and some of the impediments and all that. So it might be fresh on some of the committee members' minds if they go back and look, and how much they've actually done and whether that's that was enough, and whether we if nothing else, you can just document what transpired.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess this is a good question for everyone because, I mean, you all serve on this council, but a lot of you also have other councils or interagency or external agency councils and committees that you serve on. And I guess, you know, that there, as you all know, there has been a lot of creation of external agency work groups and task forces and all those things. And, you know, do we feel like we're really getting to the crux of the problem, or are we creating more groups? I mean, I think that's, you know, maybe something to discuss. I mean, do we think that maybe there needs to be a better coordination amongst all of these task forces and work groups that are available to us? I mean, that was something that the Pennsylvania group had written down in their recommendations for, I think it was their short-term recommendations. They said, improve communication among various external stakeholder advisory groups, and they named a bunch of them. And they had various ways in order to improve that communication. I mean, do we see communication right now amongst all of our various external agency advisory groups, or is that something that is maybe is a additional barrier?
Well, I think, you know, it depends on the group, how effective it is. Obviously, you can never have too much interagency collaboration, or I would argue that you can never have too much. I think that, you know, we need to encourage the development, the further development of partnerships, although it's really hard to, to kind of push that out to communities that may not be interested in doing that. I think, you know, one of the needs I see is for some kind of training product. I think if you rely on partnerships and kind of sharing information by word of mouth, that's a great thing, but you're also limited by the knowledge of people who are on that task force. So I would hope that we could kind of look at both the encouragement of interagency collaboration, but also some tool, not sure what it might look like, so that folks who are not in the housing arena could pick it up and, you know, understand what's out there and how to go about accessing those services.
Right. And that's definitely something that we are going to put into the biennial plan in the chapters regarding training. The reason why I brought this up is just to see if there were additional barriers that we saw in terms of those groups that exist throughout the state that are supposed to be advising state agencies, if there are barriers to their coordination that are apparent. Okay. Well, we can come back to that at a different point. So the next question that I had here for everyone on the discussion handout is, and we already touched on some of these, but different sources of the problem for coordination. So I know that Sherry had mentioned sometimes federal regulations have prevented partnerships in using financing to provide services and assistance. Are there other sources of problems with coordination, either operational methods, certain agency policies, anything that you guys can think of that we want to put down as a category of a source of coordination problems and barriers?
I think for me the crux of the problem is that the result of that siloization is that agency staff at one agency aren't aware of what programs might exist at other agencies. So if somebody, if a service provider contacts us, I'm not fully aware of what, our people may not be fully aware of what TDHCA does. So we might bounce them over to you and where they really belong somewhere else. I think the crux of, so what I guess I'm trying to say around that way is I think that the culture that stems up to the different or stems from the different federal programs creates conditions that are favorable to having staff that have tunnel vision and aren't adequately trained to make appropriate referrals.
Okay.
Right, because if an activity isn't required by the funding source, and usually interagency coordination is something you do under other duties as assigned, you know, it's really hard to be supportive. And if you've got a crushing workload and, you know that you have to, review X charts for eligibility, and you don't have a funding source or a supervisor who will allow you to either learn more or assist other agencies' staff in learning more about your program, something's got to give.
Mm-hmm. And I also think that there's, there's an obstacle or an opportunity, but I think that agencies need to be encouraged to encourage their staff to learn about other agencies and coordinate better. It's not something that staff gets rewarded for at present, and it's the expectations kind of need to come from the top.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost sort of
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Any other thoughts on that?
Ashley, it's Mark. Just a quick one to follow up. Thinking that one through, if you have a tangible, whether it's a meeting or a product to look at or something, it's a little more helpful if you were to tell staff to just kind of, you know, learn about all these entities out there. That's pretty ambitious directive, and as opposed to, hey, go to this, whether it's a half-a-day conference or a day conference or hit this one site or read this one pamphlet, I think that's a little more helpful in pulling that off, because you got to have something tangible to direct them to, and it's got to be limited, because you know you're not going to spend half of their time sending them off to learn about other people's programs. That's just the reality. So that probably ties a little bit into what we talked about earlier about some tangible training products or opportunities,
mm-hmm.
or tangible meetings or something. Something that has a certain date and a certain time or a certain
page
or a certain site or just something of that you can direct them to, as opposed to this kind of open-ended learn about your fellow agency and which is pretty broad and pretty open-ended, and generally when push comes to shove, it just gets pushed aside and they move about their regular daily tasks.
Mm-hmm. All right, great. Any other thoughts? Okay, moving on to the next question. This is more about this is something the Policy and Barriers Committee is tasked to do, which is, create the chapter on expanding upon the definition of service-enriched housing and associated terminology. And are there any things that we should be wary of including in our definition and language about our definition that could create a barrier for further coordination? Any thoughts on that? Okay.
Good question, though, Ashley. I think it's a great question. It's just about I wish I could offer some insight there, but I think they've talked before about, you got to watch the definition gets so broad, trying to include everyone, which has its advantages, but also disadvantages. So
yeah.
I think it's a good topic to revisit, though.
Okay.
And from our perspective over at DSHS, I guess, this kind of ties back to that interchange that I had with Mike and Jonas at one of the meetings, which is that if you emphasize aged and disabled, then focus is taken off a lot of our consumers who are, substance abusers or people with mental illness or all of the above, or people with HIV. And while a lot of them can fit within that definition, then not all of them can. So that's one issue that I see, and it's been resolved to my satisfaction, but it does bear on the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the Policy and Barriers Committee is trying to make sure that none of the consumer groups that could be helped would be excluded. So I guess now if we wanted to talk about any additional ideas that you all had for limited coordination barriers to put in this chapter, I know that we have previously talked about what I put in the preliminary findings of this handout, which are lack of knowledge and resources shared between agencies, Their referral process is not well coordinated, and the clients are not tracked as they are referred. No single point of entry for consumers seeking both housing and services, and no standardized assessment tool to determine eligibility for state programs. So those are preliminary barriers that I think we touched on in previous meetings, and I besides what we talked about today, I wanted to see if there's anything to add to that findings section.
Mark, never want a document to sound like you're whining, that's for sure, but,
well, this is our section to do it.
Yeah, I know, just the
never
obvious.
Never stop me.
I seem to be, the person just saying the obvious, but the lack of, funding or prioritizing that type of funding, unfortunately is a barrier, and I certainly wouldn't want it necessarily in the document, but I can give you a real life example. In the budget crunch a cycle or two back, our outreach section was the one that they axed. It was sticking out there, and it had, I guess, just the right amount of money to tidy up the budget, and it vanished in overnight, and that's understandable because we all have to balance our budgets, but it is a challenge, just the reality of prioritizing the coordination as we talked financially at all levels. And maybe we could at least just some reference to staff resources or finances,
yeah.
Even though it's a bit obvious and a bit whining.
No, I think it's a good point because I think that obviously all of the findings about single point of entry or standardized assessment tool, all those things require money. And I think that there was previous mention, and maybe Donnie, it was you or someone else that had mentioned attempts, or maybe it was just one of the speakers at the last meeting talking about attempts to create some type of standardized assessment tool and some type of using some type of internet technology to make that happen, and previous attempts, I don't know what the reason is, but have fallen by the wayside, and I don't know if anyone has the kind of institutional memory to maybe talk about any of those attempts that have been tried and failed, and talk about maybe why that happened.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
And can anyone think of anything like previous attempts? I know that that there was, and this is probably, I don't think anyone here received this money, but there was, from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services had created a technical assistance grants that went out in 2004 that were trying to integrate long-term supports with affordable housing. And I just came across that recently and was wondering what happened to those technical assistance grants that we were given. I don't know if anyone remembers that or any other type of program that has been tried.
But the CMS thing is probably a Mark Gold question.
Yeah. Okay.
Mark Gold. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I'm not so sure that there are that many previous attempts, at least at the Texas level. This is kind of a new perspective. I just haven't heard a lot of discussion about it.
Mm-hmm.
And people could be working on it hard, and I'd never hear about it, but I have been around for a while.
All right.
So I was just going to ask a question, and I hate questions to put you to work, but do you have any sense of how much Pennsylvania budgeted over, say, the last 8 years of to put Compass into operation? Is there a way was there a contact person that said, like, they set aside $5 million a year for the last 5 years? Or?
I can certainly look into that. I have not, besides looking through Compass's website and what they offer and how they offer it. I haven't looked into what their funding has been, but I can do that.
Yeah, and it's not gross. I was just curious. And I get their site. And the only problem with it is you got to pretend you're actually, you know, logging in for services. You can't really sneak a peek at it without registering, and I wasn't quite willing to register for benefits and continue to look at it.
I'm sure that I can try contacting somebody who is maybe one of the managers or, the people who run the site and see what I can find out.
Yeah, it's not crucial. I'm just curious as to what something like that costs to put together both the, direct budget as well as each agency contributing indirectly to that.
Right. That's a good idea. Is there anything else about any ideas of previous efforts to help coordination? This doesn't have to be at the state level. I mean, Donnie or anyone who knows about maybe local efforts to make sure that we're streamlining our coordination process. I could always use examples from the local level as well.
Well, I think one of the models that's working with a very limited audience are is the community transition team, and I think Mark had spoken about that at one of our previous meetings, but the players in the community transition teams are dads workers and relocation workers, and to the extent that the housing authorities will participate, representatives of the housing authorities who come together once a month and collectively develop a plan to help nursing home residents return to the community. DAD's workers are compelled to attend that meeting. They're always there. Relocation workers are compelled. They're always there. Housing folks, they're not compelled. And so in some areas, no one attends. Sometimes there'll be one person from a housing authority, but the team is concerned about a 19-county area. The person represents a city or a county. But to the extent that the housing reps have voluntarily attended those meetings, it's been a great forum.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, if I could ask you a question about that. So when you say that the housing entities and staff from those entities not being compelled to attend, do you find that to be because there is a fragmentation in terms of who these housing entities are supposed to be, or the geographic area they're representing, or the client base that they're representing? What do you find to be the lack of reason why they're not compelled, I guess?
Well, I think it comes back to either contractual obligations, and for them, I'm sure it's not. And if it's not a contractual obligation, it's usually a supervisory request. And those kinds of things will fall under other duties as assigned. So if they don't have, internal organizational support to adopt that as a good thing to do, they're not going to be at the table. And again, they, like most providers, struggle with, crushing workloads. And if you've got, these tasks that are required by your funding source and you can't get them done, it's unlikely that you're going to take on additional stuff that's not required.
Right. Okay. Thank you for that. Any other thoughts on this topic? Okay.
I think the challenge is to demonstrate value for all players.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you on that one.
And to also provide incentives to the extent practical to get folks involved. And maybe that's a request from the state agency. Maybe that's
continuing education units for people who are licensed. Maybe it's, you know, there really aren't a lot of incentives that you can offer.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, again, to the extent that you can build those in, that that helps bring people to the table.
Mm-hmm. So then, perhaps kind of coming out of that statement, what you're saying is that the barrier is a lack of incentives and a lack of, I don't know how I say it.
A lack of control over one's schedule.
Yeah.
And work assignments.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back to time and resources.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you for all this. I didn't have anything else on my discussion handout, but obviously I want to provide the opportunity to discuss any other barriers when it comes to limited coordination that people can think of. And so last call for those, and then we can move on to staff research assignments.
Well, another kind of obvious, one of the barriers is that, you know, these programs are not fixed. They're fluid, and new programs are developed as funds become available. Other programs are eliminated, put on freeze, and so it's really hard to kind of train people to an issue that's as fluid
mm-hmm.
as the resources and the programs are.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I can go to a training today and know the latest information, it may all change tomorrow.
Right.
And that's why, you know, you have to guard against relying on print materials only.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one. Thank you. All right. So I guess we should move on to the next item on the agenda. So I gave you a brief overview of what, based on our April 6th meeting and January 5th meeting, staff was working on. And I wanted to make sure that there was an opportunity that if the committee wanted to add anything to staff research assignments that you think is really necessary, either for this chapter of the outline or for Chapter 8 of the outline, which we discussed on April 6th. So please let us know now.
So I was impressed with the handout that I believe Jody of the
CAFL?
Yeah, prepared. I mean, that was really helpful to me, and that might even be kind of a starting point. I mean, somebody has taken some time to kind of sit down and explain, you know, what the programs are, who can benefit from them.
Mm-hmm. I will definitely look at her handout again, and maybe we can try to use some of the strengths of that handout as recommendations for our educational materials. Anyone else? Staff research requests?
Well, Ashley, and I'm sure you've already gone down this road, but I mean, we have some good solid materials of what the Pennsylvania experience is. If there are any other states that are that have embarked on something similar, that would be useful information. And you know, how they addressed it, of course, if it's Pennsylvania by itself, then that'll tell us a lot about what the state of these efforts are.
Right. Yep, that's true. Okay, and I will continue to see if I can find anything. And unfortunately, I think, you know, part of the problem is that a lot of people just don't report on it. So I will see, maybe I will try to use other avenues of research than just the internet and any other referrals I get.
Well, I think that if they don't report on it, then that's a measure of the seriousness with which it is taken. And, you know, just so you're not looking at 50 states and territories, you may want to just focus on the ones that have comparable populations and
right.
You know, spread it to Texas. I mean,
right.
Rhode Island's effort to coordinate is not going to be, I don't think, useful to us on a statewide level.
Right. That is true. Okay. All right. I will look into that.
Actually, just one other thing. I thought the comment about the Your Texas benefits was good, and I did get on it while we were talking. And I haven't had a chance to look at how comprehensive that is, but is there kind of a list or of what's out there now? And it would, that might be somewhat helpful. Again, I don't know if this is, and the other one mentioned are the basically the only two, or if there's some others already existing. If your report is just you know, meant to be a reference document, among other things, it'd be nice to have at least a list of where Texas stands right now.
Okay. So in terms of how we stand
coordinating delivery of benefits, I assume that's what the Your Texas Benefits does within whatever scope it offers. I know the one in Pennsylvania
right.
was quite, you know, you would click on all the various benefits and you can start to proceed, but then of course I want you to log on so it's really
sure.
I believe the intent is for the consumer to be able to go in and enter identifying information, and for those programs that are part of a database, it will let the consumer now know, based on the information you've given me, it looks like you qualify for Children's Health Insurance Program. I'm not sure if it pre-populates an application. I'm not sure if it generates an application, but it is intended to conduct kind of a preliminary screening and let folks know the benefits that should be available to them based on the information they've provided.
And it's probably limited to the HHSC.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is.
Right.
Which should be, you know, TANF and food stamps and
right.
And
now, there was
insurance programs.
Right. There was a companion program, and I tried to search for it as we've been talking this morning, and I came up dry. But at one time, the Texas Department of Aging and Disability Services had a screening tool. I thought it was called STAR, but the references I pulled up this morning were for other programs. Mark might be familiar with that tool as well. But that was really a broader tool so that if somebody went in and entered information, it would indicate whether or not the user is eligible for in-home services through DADS, or it kind of went beyond the health insurance and the income program to capture other kinds of long-term services and support.
Okay. I will see if Mark can help me out with that.
Personally,
looking at that website, I do know that they're networked into 211. So,
right.
That's,
and I think 211 is a major player because they actually have call takers who can answer questions and assist people who don't qualify for those programs.
Mm-hmm. Although, from what I've heard, that it's the information you're asking for, is the information that they give limited, or is it just a remote?
Very, yeah.
Well, they have a lot of territory to cover. For example, we used them as our call center during the H1N1 episode. Mm-hmm. And we actually hired nurses to talk to people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they deal with such huge volumes that I think the average call is less than 2 minutes. So it's really intended to be a very quick, you know, call, state your need, get 3 referrals, and get off the line.
Right. It's not really like, let's chat about your options.
Ideally, but the reality is that given the call volumes, that's not really an option.
And so, you know, I guess my thought is they're not necessarily part of the solution, but they certainly are part of the current landscape.
Right.
All right. Great.
Actually, this is Kenneth.
Uh-huh.
They have an organization in Livingston at where all the agencies come together once a month and meet and talk with each other to try to keep the camaraderie going. So would it be befitting to get some to visit? I visit that organization once, and it looks like they have a lot of people attend once a month where they just try to keep in touch with one another so they can pass our business card and discuss what each other's doing. So it would be feasible to visit that organization again and get some feedback that could be helpful to this. I certainly don't mind joining again.
Sure. And what's the name of the organization?
I'll have to get that. I have a brochure I have to get on them. I just know they meet once a month in Livingston. All the agencies come together.
Okay, yeah. You can definitely email me or mail me any information that you can gather from them, and I can take a look at it.
I'll do that.
Thank you so much. Okay, so in terms of our last agenda item, discussion of next steps, the committee, is there a sense of where we want to go for our next conference call, which I believe would be May 6th, if that's the Thursday in 2 weeks? Can anyone verify that for me? I think it's May 6th. Is there a thought of, like, where maybe we should focus next? Or maybe people can send me feedback about that, how we feel.
Next 2 weeks Thursday is the 6th.
6th, okay. And I also will remind everyone that we have our full council meeting, our quarterly council meeting on May 10th, Monday, May 10th. So we will all be coming together for that. And I don't know if maybe the May 6th conference call maybe is an opportunity to see if we want to come together to present something at the full council meeting so that the rest of the council that's not on this committee can hear about the ideas that have come up and what we have put together so far for the biennial plan. Maybe that's an opportunity that we can discuss, that we can talk about at the next conference call, is how do we want to share this information that we've discussed with the full council. Is that an idea that anyone likes?
That's fine.
And Terry, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay, great. Yeah, I think that it would be great to try to have you as the chair make some type of presentation on May 10th to the full council about our efforts so far since our last meeting of the full council, if that's not a problem.
Not a problem at all.
Great. Great. All right, any thoughts for next steps? I can always send that around some ideas by email if that maybe works better. Okay. All right, great. Well, thank you, everyone, for getting on the call, and I'm glad that we had the majority of the council able to, or committee able to make it. So thank you, everyone, and I will definitely be sending out some follow-up about staff research as well as our next conference call.
Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you. Bye-bye.